introduction to the problem we're dealing, which is the fact that Shabbos, on the one hand, is so supremely important within Judaism. We talked about how Yeshaya uses it as the example of mitzvos ben adam lamakom, our relationship with Hashem. The punishment for violating it is severe. The Jews go to exile for not observing Shabbos. It's so primary and so important. Recollection that Hashem created the world, it's fundamental to Judaism. On the other hand, so is saving lives. And we talked about the duty to protect your own life, and not only to protect your life, meaning like life and death, but also to protect your health overall. And we also talked about the duty to save the lives of others. And so our question, which we started on last time, is what happens when these two very big values in Judaism go head to head? What happens when, on the one hand, I have to observe Shabbos, and on the other hand, I have to save lives? We noted the possibility last time that maybe this is called observing Shabbos, saving lives, but it still doesn't answer the question, because how do I know whether what I'm doing is saving lives? How do I know to what extent it overrides Shabbos? Right? That's our basic problem. And we started dividing levels of danger, levels of medical need. And what we're doing now is a brief introduction to that, and then we're going to go one by one and talk about each level of need before then getting into, okay, so what do you do for each level of need, and how does that translate into practical cases? Everybody good? Okay? I realize the heat is going to put people to sleep. Do your best. I'm going to do my best also. Okay. So the first level of need is, we talked about it last time, somebody who is dangerously ill. That's the easy case, so to speak. Not for the person who is ill, but for everybody else. Because you know what to do, which is anything and everything. We're going to talk about how far that goes. I'll give you a classic question, which we're not going to answer right now. But very simple and straightforward. You have somebody who is in the hospital who is unquestionably life in danger, dangerously ill. They're in the ICU, that kind of thing. So you want to take care of them with whatever is needed to save their lives. But what about taking vitals every hour on the hour? How important is it that you record their temperature every hour on the hour, that you take the blood pressure every hour on the hour, or whatever it is? I'm making up that it's every hour. I don't, know the protocol for a particular case. There are things that we do on behalf of people which may not really be about saving their lives in the moment, but it's the normal way you take care of somebody who is experiencing that condition, whatever the condition is. So what do you do about things like that? Even things that aren't like taking vitals, but things that are involved in general care and comfort of the patient. What about things like that? What about, let's say, giving a painkiller to somebody who, again, is in a life and death situation? Their pain is not really directly contributing to the danger to their lives, but it would be normal to give them painkillers for it. Things like that. So we'll have to talk about that. I'm not addressing it now. I'm just raising it to show it's not all straightforward when you're talking about people who are in life and death situations. Clear? Understood? Okay. The second level down is safek pikuach nefesh. What about when they might be in danger? We don't know. And frankly, that's where a lot of cases come in, because you don't know with certainty. And as I said last time, safek, doubt, is a really big place. That could be somebody who, let's say, at the beginning of the pandemic came in with COVID, but they were under 50, no history of problems, and so on. But on the other hand, at that point, the concern for death was very, very high. And it could include somebody who gets COVID now, who, maybe has some degree of pre-existing conditions and there's some concern, clearly not the same as it was 3 years ago. So the there's a big range, and we're going to have to obviously deal with that. But those were the cases that we talked about last time. I should note, the things that we talked about last time, I should have said this before, the things we talked about last time in terms of pikuach nefesh and safek pikuach nefesh are indeed part of the quiz that we will hopefully get to today. So don't like throw that out. Ariana.
What does safek mean again?
Doubt. Yeah. Good? Yeah. Sorry? So I printed out and gave out to people who asked me now, including, I printed out like five, and I only had two people who asked. You emailed me. Can someone who didn't email me please donate one to someone who did email me?
Yeah.
Okay, so there you go. Okay, we're good. Thank you. So the third category is what's called sakanas eiver. Sakanas eiver is not so easy to define. The word eiver means part of the body. It's a tricky word because it gets used different ways in different contexts in the Gemara and in Halacha. It's not a word that has a good English translation. That's the problem. Sometimes you'll see people translate it as limb. Sometimes you'll see people translate it as organ. But it's neither of those. You may have heard the idea that the body has, or the male body potentially, has 248 evarim in it. That's a Mishnah in Maseches Aholos. But when they count them out and tell you how you get to the 248, you realize it's not limb and it's not organ. Easy example, skin is an organ of the body. Skin is not one of the evarim. On the other hand, a whole bunch of bones that are in the hands are broken down into each one being its own aver. So you can't really say it's the hand is it. It's not. Different parts are. It's just not a word with an English translation. So I use body part, which is also really technically incorrect, because not all parts of the body are evarim. Your earlobe is not an aver. It is a body part. But that's the term that's used in halacha. And what it means is, and this is really what matters for us, the term sakanas eiver means danger to a body part. Not danger to life, but danger to a body part. Morel, you were going to say?
I was going to ask.
Okay, yeah. So sakana means danger. Eiver, body part. Sakanas eiver is danger to a body part. Are we clear? So what exactly constitutes danger? Example. What if you have somebody who loses a tooth? The tooth falls out. You have usually, with many tooth injuries, about 24 hours to reinsert it, and it will be able to take, and then after that it's not going to take. They're going to need something artificial. Is that now, I don't know if that's still true. That was true the last time I learned this topic. What? Yeah, there's a whole thing about how to preserve it, keeping it in milk. As funny as that sounds, actually may be a good idea. I am not giving medical advice. Let me make sure that I say that for the entire year. If you want medical advice, talk to a medical professional. But in terms of this tooth, does that qualify as danger to a body part? On the one hand, I'd say, well, yes, because if you don't take care of it, the tooth is gone. On the other hand, your mouth is going to function without most of your teeth. You know, certain teeth may be more critical than others. So does that really count as danger to a body part? It's the mouth. Is it the tooth? Yeah, Ariana.
Would it also be depending on what time it happens on Shabbos? Like if something happens Friday night, would the treatment be different than it happening like 4 hours before Shabbos is over?
Right. So that's one of the questions that we will need to discuss. What if you could wait for after Shabbos? And yes, it will be a factor for sure in the conversation. Yeah, Ella.
If tooth is one of the 248, then...
So that's the question, is does tooth really count? We're going to talk about this. I'm not just, you know, throwing it out there and going to leave you hanging all year. You just need patience. Another example where this comes up is a big debate regarding fertility treatments. In the event that fertility treatments are needed in order to be able to become pregnant, can you argue that the body part, in this case the uterus, is not able to function without the treatment, and therefore you should treat, even if the timing for the treatment happens to be Shabbos? Can you make that argument? We'll have to discuss. I'm not answering that question now either. I'm just trying to show how this gets complicated. It's not as simple as saying, well, you know, they were in some kind of an accident and their finger is now, you know, hanging off and needs to be reattached. Sorry. Don't mean to gross everybody out, but there are a lot of complicated cases that are involved. Take a look at where did I bring it on the sheet? Oh, I see what I did. I thought that I brought it on here, but I didn't. All right, never mind. Don't take a look at the sheet because it's not on here. I thought I had brought a source that actually discuss this in some detail, but I see that it's not on here. I'll tell it to you outside of the text. It will come back later on when we get to discuss each category on a granular level. But Rabbi Yehoshua Neuwirth, is the author of a very important work on the laws of Shabbos called Shmira Shabbos Kehilchasa, Shmirat Shabbat Kehilchata. And he is quoted as saying that danger to a body part means that a part of the body will no longer function the way that it normally does. That's what it means. A part of the body no longer functions the way that it normally does. Rabbi Neuwirth, yeah. And just to tell you, that will be one of the quiz questions. So, Neuwirth, his name isn't part of the quiz question. His definition is part of it. But one of the areas in which things get a little tricky is, we're down to this red marker again, huh? I bet this one it doesn't work. Ha! I bet correctly. I could have had that down. I could have written on it. It wouldn't have mattered. So I was going to write out the categories for you, but yeah. Hey, is it a big deal for people? You want it? Yes? No?
It's a marker.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. It's dry erase, right?
Yeah.
Before I scroll over the board, thank you. I did learn about Purell last time. Okay. So again, our first category was. This is a good marker. I really hope it erases. although, there are worse things to have stuck on the board than the words Bikuach Nefesh. But I think I will check it. It erases, but not easily.
It's the eraser.
It may be the eraser, but I think I'm just going to skip this. I believe that it's the eraser. I mean, it says dry erase on it. Now it says Bikuach Nefesh, yes. I don't want to stick around there after class, you know, wiping away at all the words. So, Pikuach Nefesh is your first one. Then you had Safek Pikuach Nefesh, if you're in doubt. Then you had this Sakanas Eiver, danger to a body part. And then you have what's called Chole She'ein Bo Sakana. Chole, someone who's ill. She'ein Bo Sakana. Ein is not. There is no danger. They're suffering from an illness, which is not, even left unchecked, going to take their lives. As opposed to Pikuach Nefesh, which is Chole She'yesh Bo Sakana, when there is danger to life. Here there is no danger to life. Can you quantify that? The Shulchan Aruch tries. If you take a look on your sheet at source number one, Rabbi Yosef Karo in the Shulchan Aruch, he says the following, and I'm reading out my English translation. You can see the original Hebrew there as well. I may go back and forth to show something. We'll see. For one who is bedridden from illness, but not endangered, they're confined to bed. Okay, their life is going to be fine. They're going to survive. But they can't walk around. They're in a lot of pain. They have a fever. They feel very weak. So they can't walk around. That's the category we're talking about. The Ramah, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, adds the words that are in brackets. Or one who is in such pain that his whole body is ill. Even if he can walk, he is like one who is bedridden. So maybe you can walk around. You're not confined to bed. But you're in really grotesque pain. So what do? So he first says, we tell a non-Jew to heal him. But we would not violate biblical laws of Shabbat, even were an organ endangered. There I actually translated it as organ. I took this from an old source sheet of mine from a different class, and I really should have changed it to body part, so I'm going to do that on my own sheet. But every time it says organ, think body part, not organ. What we're saying is we are not willing to violate biblical laws of Shabbos, not for the case of chole she'ein bo sakana, someone who's not dangerously ill, and not for the case where there's danger to a body part either. We're not willing to do that. We're willing to ask a non-Jew to do it. Now, there's a basic prohibition called amira la'akum. What does amira la'akum mean? Asking a non-Jew to do something on Shabbos. Exactly. Amira, lemor, amar, to say. Akum. Akum is an acronym which I would write on the board, but I'm not going to. Because marker. But Akum stands for Oved Kochavim Umazalot. Somebody who serves idols. Somebody who serves literally stars and constellations. Amira la'aklam, asking a non-Jew to do things for me on Shabbos, is usur, it is prohibited. A variety of reasons and sources are brought for why it's usur, which we're not going to discuss right now, but it is a rabbinic prohibition. So asking a non-Jew to take care of this person is okay because it's rabbinically prohibited to ask him, and we're overriding that for this person who is bedridden, for this person who's in great pain. Clear? Yeah, Natalie.
Is that to say that the rabbinic prohibition is less severe?
Good point. So the answer is yes and no. Yes, we are treating the rabbinic prohibition as less severe than the biblical, but we shouldn't make the mistake of thinking that that means overall rabbinic prohibitions are less important, because Torah is a composite. Torah is a complete unit. And one of the halachos in the Torah is to follow the rabbinic laws. The Torah says, "V'lo sasur mikol advarim," don't stray from all the things that they tell you, right or left. So therefore, rabbinic laws are quasi-biblical. However, built into this system is the idea that rabbinic law was not created for circumstances where it would cause somebody great pain. In other words, it's an understanding within rabbinic law itself. I should put that in my notes for any other time I teach this, because it's important to explain. But but it's built into the rabbinic law that it can be overridden for circumstances like this. That's what we understand it. So what it means is that you can ask the non-Jew to take care of this person who is bedridden. Clear? But that's not the only option, which is good, because sometimes there isn't somebody who isn't Jewish around, you know, available for you to consult. Now what am I going to do to take care of the patient? So the Shulchan Aruch brings multiple possible approaches. He says, as far as having a Jew violate a rabbinic prohibition, in other words, let's say you don't have a non-Jew available, but there's something you're able to do for the sake of the patient that is only rabbinically prohibited, not biblically prohibited. Just like I permitted asking the non-Jew, maybe I could also permit a Jew to do some other rabbinic prohibition. So, for example, I'm trying to think of an example that won't create other problems. Okay, an injection. The halacha is that, well, start the other way. Medically, there are two classes of injections that halacha is concerned about. One type is intravenous, the other type is intramuscular. Okay, intravenous means it's an injection into the vein. Intramuscular is when it just goes under the skin, right? It's not going into a blood vessel. And the difference between the two for our purposes, sorry?
One draws blood.
Exactly. Intravenous is going to draw blood. First of all, when you seat the needle in the vein, you draw back a little bit to make sure that it's properly seated within the blood vessel and take some blood out. I'm not getting into more than that right now because that's enough for our purposes. But the point is that taking blood, causing bleeding, is a biblical prohibition on Shabbos. Whereas injecting something under the skin that's not going going there is actually rabbinically prohibited. So let's say you have somebody who is ill, not dangerously so. An intramuscular injection, I can't imagine what, but again, I'm not the doctor, so I'm stopping short of prescribing anything, could be something that would help them. Yeah?
What about like a growth hormone shot?
It's an interesting question. We might come back to that when we talk about sort of routine care type issues, when someone's taking a course of things, and that may become relevant there. I'm not sure, just on a medical perspective, how regularly those need to be taken and at a particular time of day or something such that it would need to be on Shabbos, but it's it's an area of medicine I really don't know a whole lot about. Yes,
so,
Morel, right?
The injection is not breaking Shabbos.
I didn't say that. I said it's rabbinic. It's a rabbinic prohibition, potentially. But it will be justified, potentially, and that's what I want to talk about, is are you allowed, as a Jew, to do one of these things? Abby, yeah.
If someone is diabetic,
so, right, so diabetes is something I intend to discuss later in the syllabus because it's a longer discussion. Diabetes is challenging to talk about because depending on the history of the patient, the needs are different. are we talking about type 1, type 2? Are we talking about someone who has an insulin pump versus injections? Are we talking about somebody whose blood sugar level has been erratic? Like, there are so many different factors involved that I want to treat diabetes as its own area. Yeah? Yeah, so what he said was, you could ask a non-Jew to provide care, because the non-Jew, you're asking a non-Jew, is a rabbinic prohibition, and that's justified for the sake of this patient. That's the idea. Chayala?
Like, for the one that you would take blood on Shabbos, can a non-Jew do that?
So I'm not going to answer that question yet. We need to get to... I mean, it sounds like yes, but there's a question of assisting when you have blood taken and the role of the patient. So it's going to depend on the level of necessity for them and how the blood would be taken. So I'm not ready to answer that question yet. Ricky?
So the reason why you can ask a non-Jew is because it's rabbinic, but what if you're asking a non-Jew to perform something that's assertive?
So no, it's a rabbinic prohibition for me to ask him,
right.
But he can then do whatever. Including diuresis, right.
So you can ask him and he can do whatever. It's not only specific to rabbinic birth.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. I saw another hand in this area. No. Oh, was it Bailey? You had a question?
Yeah. I wanted to know, you were starting to say that, like, if there's no non-Jew around, then there might be a way that a Jew could potentially, like, how does that make sense?
So that's where we're going. That's where we're going with this. What's your name?
I'm
sorry.
I'm Daniela.
Daniela, okay. So you were going to say? All right, same question. Okay. Yeah.
Sorry, I just had a question on the Shulchanar. When it says, like, the last line and the third view.
Oh, okay. So that's where we haven't read that yet. That's what I'm trying to get to.
Okay.
So as far as having a Jew do something that's rabbinically prohibited, we have a range of views. Some allow that, even if there's no danger to a body part. Just somebody who is ill but not dangerously so, a Jew could do a rabbinically prohibited act themselves. That's one view. Second view, some permit violation if a body part is endangered. It has to be at that level of sakanas aver, of danger to a body part, in order for it to be justified. Third view, which I underline because this is the one he's going to like, some permit direct violation if a body part is endangered, and violation in an altered way if no body part is endangered. This is what we call, in Hebrew, what's a shinui. Exactly. Doing it in an unusual way. We're going to devote a lot of time to what constitutes a shinui and what doesn't. So don't worry about that right now. If you want to think of what's an altered way, classic example would be, if you're a righty, writing with your left hand. That will be an example of a shinui.
Sorry, could you repeat the three cases?
The first view says that we only allow a Jew to violate a derabbanan personally that we will allow it whether we're talking about cholasha imbo sakana or sakanas aver, danger to a body part. Second view says we only allow it for sakanas aver, danger to a body part. Third view says that we permit directly in the event that there's danger to a body part. We permit indirectly if there's no danger to a body part. Now, let me explain a little bit about why we distinguish between telling a non-Jew, which is rabbinically prohibited, and other rabbinic prohibitions. What's the difference? The answer is because when you deal with most rabbinic prohibitions on Shabbos, they tend to be tied to a biblical prohibition. So, for example, the Torah says that I'm not allowed to perform malacha on Shabbos. One of the malachos is digging a hole on Shabbos. In the event that I'm digging the hole, well, you know, let me not use that example. That's not a great example. That's going to get me into more complicated territory than I need. Sorry, scratch that. Sorry?
Oh, I mean, are you trying to come up with, like, an example of something? It's like, what's the real issue, like, behind swimming? It's like, may lead you to, like, build a raft.
Yeah. I that's going to take me into another direction that I don't really want to go. Too many directions that I don't want to use. So let's take the following. Let's say putting out a fire where you don't want to preserve the wick for later use. Okay? It's just a destructive act. That's all it is. The biblical prohibition against putting out a fire only applies if you extinguish it for the sake of being able to light wick later on. That's the biblical prohibition. Rabbinically, I'm not allowed to extinguish a fire, you know, in either circumstance. There, the rabbinic prohibition is a protection for the biblical. That's serious. As opposed to where the rabbinic prohibition is telling a non-Jew, that's sort of in a vacuum. That's on its own. It's not related to other things. Do you follow the difference? This rabbinic prohibition against telling a non-Jew is just a thing unto itself. It's a separate rule. It's not connected to anything biblical. It's just on its own. It's independent. And it's considered less severe than where it's actually meant to protect and prevent violation of a biblical prohibition. The result of that is that the rabbinic prohibition of telling a non-Jew to do it on Shabbos, that's something that I'm allowed to do clearly. Whether there's a danger to a body part, whether it's just chol she'en bo sakana, doesn't make a difference. Whereas, if we're talking about an issue of a rabbinic prohibition that's tied to a biblical one, like putting out a fire without, you know, not for the sake of lighting it again, but just putting out a fire, so that's more severe, and that's where some say, no, only if there's danger to a body part. Rena? No? Okay. Is that clear? We understand the difference. Yeah. I can't possibly. But if you look on your sheet, like it's relatively straightforward in the cases. Some will allow you to do the rabbinic prohibition yourself. In all cases, whether it's danger to a body part, whether it's just chol she'en bo sakana, some will only allow it if it's danger to a body part. They take that as being more severe. And some will say, if there's danger to a body part, you can do it straight. If there's no danger to a body part, you have to do it in an unusual way. That's the answer. Yeah, Rick.
So, like, how far can you go to get an injury? Like, can you call someone, can you make a
bell? No, it's talking about talking directly to an injury.
Talking directly,
yes.
Like
correct. That's what we're talking about. Because otherwise, you've already gone into rabbinic prohibitions or worse in order to get them. The point of getting them is that you don't end up violating anything other than telling them. That's the idea. Gabriella, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
What is shinui?
Shinui is an unusual way. I gave the example of writing with your left hand. There was a hand back there. Yes. Naomi?
Okay. You're telling a non-Jew to do it, you can tell him to do it in Doraisa?
Correct. Correct. So the conclusion. Yeah, Addie.
Sorry. So when you were saying that sometimes it's permitted to do Doraisa with the shinui, right? And then you mentioned about doing.
So we haven't discussed rabbinic with a shinui. He's dealing with deraisas. Yeah. So I'm skipping the next to last line because I don't want to create more confusion than I already have. But the last line is the key. The third view, the one I underlined, appears correct. So the Shulchan Aruch's view is that in the event that there is a danger to a body part, you can violate a derabanan. In the event that there's no danger to a body part, you need a derabanan with a shinui in an unusual way. Yes?
Can you just clarify with Abby that we're talking about, I'm not supposed to use the derabanan, but that we're talking about derabanan to use it for, as far as for having a derabanan with a shinui?
Sorry. One second. What was your question again? I want to make sure I answered it right.
I was saying that, is it that you can
okay, no, we're talking about derabanans with a shinui. I misunderstood your question. Okay, thank you. Yes?
Just to clarify, are like all of these like four answers for like foods and like zeros as opposed to all of the prohibitions? Then it's like what you were saying before about the unlawful not being food.
Right, so it's talking specifically about, correct, these others. There's one other halacha which creates confusion on this, but I don't want to get into it now, which is mukta. How do we view mukta? Is it less severe than other derabanans? As a standalone entity also. Okay, so the position of the Shulchan Aruch, one second, the position of the Shulchan Aruch is that for a case of sakanas, of chol she'en bo sakana, the person is not in danger, but, or and, there's no danger to a body part, you can either get a non-Jew or violate a rabbinic prohibition with a shinui in an unusual way. In the event that there's danger to a body part, then you don't need the shiur. You don't need the unusual way. Morale, you were asking.
I was wondering whether what you can do it in an unusual way. It's either you act on yourself or you can do something in an unusual way, like for example, the left hand. Is that if you can't act for yourself?
What do you mean?
Wait, what was that scenario where you would use your left hand? Like, why would you?
To do it in an unusual way. Because you're not allowed to do it directly. That's the point. In other words, let me take a step back. I really want to spend a whole like chunk of time on shinui, and I'm not really getting into it in depth right now.
Okay.
But the point is that the Torah's prohibition against malacha really applies when it's done in the normal way, and doing it in an unusual way is a way to reduce the severity of the violation. That's the core idea. That's the core idea. Julie.
Yeah.
Okay.
This only applies to Kola She'en Bo Sakana and not Sakana
Eber. So Sakana's Eber is when they talk about the danger to a body part.
Yeah.
So his conclusion is that no shinui is needed to do a derabanan for someone in that position.
Okay.
Yes.
Do you have to ask about the Eber or you can just use shinui?
That's a great question. I want to come back to it. We're not dealing with that right now, but it's a good question, which I hope to come back to, but it's not going to be today. Yes.
When you say this is the position accepted in Shulchan Aruch, is that also accepted in the Ramah?
So that, I believe, is the Ramah's view. I believe that's the conclusion that the Ashkenazim accept as well. Yes, I believe so. I reserve the right to change my mind later, but I believe so. The category of Chola She'en Bo Sakana, so far we've said, is the person who's bedridden, the person who's in great pain, right? There's one more category of Chola She'en Bo Sakana, and that's in source number two. The Rama adds, one may tell a non-Jew to prepare food for a minor who lacks it, right? If you have a kid on Shabbos who needs food, you could ask a non-Jew to prepare it. A minor is as one who is ill, but not dangerously so. Meaning, hang on, I'm going to explain more. Minors are automatically in the category of Chola She'en Bo Sakana. However, and this is a big however, you have to define minor, which I assume was your question. Minor does not mean up to the age of 18. That is not what a minor means. Minor may not even mean up to the age of 12 or 13. We have to come back to what constitutes a minor.
Isn't it also the child?
Not necessarily for this halacha. For other halachas, that does matter. But here, it's a physiological issue. I mean,
because like if a child understands, like Shabbos, like I can't have this right now, versus a child, it's like I want.
Right. So this is about their physical health, as opposed to how upset they are.
I guess
the two can overlap.
Oh, no.
But generally speaking, not. So we haven't defined an age yet. Right now, we've just said a young child. That's what we're working with. Automatically in the category of Chola She'en Bo Sakana. Correct. That's the idea. Automatically, yes. Sorry.
What about Bishalach?
What about Bishalach?
Like if you're having
So now I understand. I'm dealing right now with laws of Shabbos as opposed to other issues. So I'm gonna stick to the laws of Shabbos. It's a good question, but beyond the scope of what I'm gonna be able to get to. Tova.
There are situations that where asking a non-Jew,
so that's a good question also. When you talk about asking a non-Jew, do you have to hint or can you just say it? So we're gonna come back to that issue, not today, but it is a topic we have to talk about. Yes. So
I feel like at some point,
right,
like the medical one is kind of
so I think the distinction between old and young is a good question. I think the distinction between old and young is probably because when you're dealing with young, we're defining a category and saying, I don't care, don't tell me anything about this kid's physical robustness. It doesn't matter. A kid of this age is in this category. Whereas with people who are older, it's harder to define exactly where that's going to kick in, at what age and in what physical condition.
So instead, they just don't get any.
So we just say evaluate them like any other chola.
Okay.
I think also it may be relevant. It's an interesting question. I think it may also be because with a child, you don't have the ability to evaluate them as easily. Children can't necessarily report accurately on their condition.
At some point, like, I mean, this might be
Right, right. And then you do end up with people who are assumed to be chola, you know, for that reason. But again, you can't define a category for that. Diagnosing dementia and saying, well, I'm not saying that that was the case there, but in general. So going from mild to moderate to severe, like, these lines are very, very hard to work with.
Are the minors automatically the category of if there is no danger to life?
Correct. Unless you know there is, but...
Like, so a kid, or like whatever the minor definition will be, why is there no danger to life?
That's the assumption, walking in. If you know of a danger to life, that's fine. But, like, we're talking about, you know, a kid who is, you know, a year old or 2 years old and running outside and they trip and they fall, right? Their life's not in danger.
Oh, okay.
But we treat them as chole shein bo sakana.
If they're like bedridden, like, okay.
If they're bedridden, they're chole shein bo sakana automatically. Then they need to be a child. Right. Okay. The last category is what's called either miktsas choli, which means ktsas, right? Ktse is the edge of something. Miktsas choli means a little bit ill, or alternatively, mechush. They have an ache. They're not bedridden. They're not in, oh, I'm in such pain, I can't deal with it. You know, you're not comfortable. You've got a headache, a little bit of a stomach ache, something like that. There's no danger. So if you take a look at source number 3 from the Shulchan Aruch, one who has a mere ache, who strengthens himself and walks as one who is healthy, you're able to walk around, may not have treatment, even via non-Jew, lest one grind ingredients. Now, the lest one grind ingredients I want to come back to, we're not there yet, so just pretend you didn't see those words. But the point is, if somebody has a cough, if somebody has a headache, but not something that makes them bedridden, we're not in migraine territory, they're not comfortable. So the rule is, leave it be, deal with it. Yes, you won't enjoy Shabbos as much. That's life. Yes.
I remember learning that if you always have that certain type of headache that you know will lead to a migraine, you're allowed to take medicine so it doesn't get worse.
So the discussion of cases that may get worse is one we have to get to. That's a different story. Gabriella.
Are you not allowed to take like
So we're going to talk about this. It's a good question. It's our very next topic. There's a lot to talk about. So right now I will only tell you it's sources from 5 through the end of this source sheet, 5 through 28. So don't make any assumptions yet. We have to get there. I also brought for you in source number 4, the Rambam has a discussion here where he says one may tell a non-Jew to do that which is only rabbinically prohibited on Shabbos if there is some illness. Miktsas choli is the term that he uses. If you have this person who has a headache, and there's a way you could take care of it by having a non-Jew do something, which itself is only rabbinically prohibited. I really wish I could write on the board, because I feel like that would clarify, but if you look on your sheet at the table, that may be helpful. Take a look on the sheet. At this table that we have there. The first category, dangerously ill, right? Chole sheyesh bo sakana. And you jump to the last column. I'm skipping the cases column. These are cases we've talked about. And we say, whatever would be done during the week, that's what you do. You don't do a shino, you don't do it in an unusual way, you just save the person's life. Danger to an aver, to a body part. So we say you violate rabbinic prohibitions. And as the third line in the Shulchan Aruch said, you don't need to do it in an unusual way. If a person is ill, but not dangerously so, then you ask a non-Jew to perform actions that we're not allowed to do, that are biblically prohibited for us. Or you can violate rabbinic prohibitions with a shinui in an unusual way, and even without a shinui if need be. And that's something we still have to discuss. We haven't gotten there yet, so... don't worry about that. And then the last category, ask a non-Jew to perform acts which we are rabbinically prohibited from doing. That's your set of cases. Are we clear? Somewhat clear? Yes. What's your name? I'm sorry?
Rebecca.
Rebecca, okay. Rebecca Cohn or Saraf? Saraf, okay. Who is Rebecca Cohn? I'm going to get it right. Okay, hi.
The fourth one?
Yes.
Are we directly asking the non-Jew or
indirectly? In the fourth one also comes back to the question of how you address a non-Jew in these, and we're going to talk about it. I'm not ready for that just yet. Ella.
Yeah.
So we don't follow Shulchan Aruch about
the school? So I brought you the Rambam there. I didn't bring you the Shulchan Aruch discussion beyond that one line in number 3. There's more to see in the Shulchan Aruch about it. Like I said, we're going to come back to all of these categories. So we'll see more about it. Yes, Natalie.
For the last column, didn't we just say that if it's not endangering his life and it's just like a slight headache or a cough or whatever, you deal with it and not even a non-Jew can do it?
Say it again.
If like it's just a slight headache,
yeah.
In the last column,
yes.
I see here that acceptable treatment on Shabbat is to ask a non-Jew, but I thought that it said over here that you may not even ask.
Right. So so what I brought you in the column is what we're going to get to when we break out each individual case, but it's not the Shulchan Aruch in number 3. It is the Rambam in number 4, but it's not the Shulchan Aruch in number 3. Okay. And then there's one more category we need to talk about, and this is kind of the big one. We're going to talk about the prohibition, and then we're going to have to. But then we'll have a quiz about it, and then we'll talk about the exceptions to the prohibition. I'm not sure we're going to get to the quiz today. It may end up being what we do, like, first thing next time. We'll just see how well we do on time. I don't want to, you know, cut off your time for it. So here's the issue of grinding ingredients. There is a rabbinic prohibition against taking medicine on Shabbos because of concern that you might grind up ingredients to create the medication. That's our fear. I brought you in source number 5, it's a Mishnah. Hebrews at the bottom of one side, English at the top of the next side, where we find this idea. This is an example of it. Mishnah says, on Shabbos, one may not eat any food for healing, and drink any beverage other than palm water, like palm tree, palm water, or a cup of roots, which is for jaundice. And we'll talk about why that's different. I'm not there right now. But one may drink palm water for thirst and pour oil of roots on one's skin for non-medical purposes. So you're not allowed. Hang on, I just want to make sure I did one thing right in my translation. Yeah, I messed up on my translation. That's very funny. The translation is right on your sheet. I read it out incorrectly. One may eat any food for healing and drink any beverage. Meaning, if there is a food that people eat normally and it happens to be that it'll cure your headache. So let's say you have a caffeine headache, right? And eating chocolate takes care of your caffeine headache. So that's 100% fine. That's not called taking medicine on Shabbos. It's called eating food. Happens to be, it takes care of your condition. That's fine. You can drink any beverage. So you have a caffeinated drink, and that takes care of it. It's not called taking coffee as medicine. It's just called drinking coffee. That's okay. The exceptions are the palm water and the cup of roots that people make for jaundice, which we have to talk about. But one may drink palm water for thirst. This palm water, which is a medication, you can drink it if you're thirsty. You're allowed to pour the oil of roots on your skin for non-medical purposes.
You can't use, like, creams and oil
in the shop. So creams are a whole different.
But oils, is that not included in the cream?
No. I'm gonna hang in there. One who has a toothache should not gargle with vinegar as a cure for the toothache. But you may use it as a dip in the normal way. You use it as a salad dressing, and it happens to be that it soothes your toothache. I don't know if vinegar is actually good for toothaches. Feel free to try it. Let me know. Right, salt water. He's talking about vinegar here. Hang in there. And if it works to heal the tooth, then you are healed. This is the Mishnah. The Mishnah doesn't want me to take medication on Shabbos. The exception of the palm water that you drink for thirst is something I'm not going to deal with right now. What is the issue here? What is this about? So if you take a look at source number 6, I'm going to skip the case involving the animal in the interests of time and just read what Ula says, because that's really the key part. This is a decree lest one grind ingredients. In the Gemara's terminology, gezerah, it's a decree, mishum shchikas samamanim, because of grinding ingredients. And what that means is, people normally make medication, historically made medication. Today it's big companies that do it, for the most part, although not exclusively, as we'll see. But you would grind things up into powder, and then take the powder as your medication. One of the malachos of Shabbos, one of the biblical prohibitions on Shabbos, is grinding things up. Therefore, you're not allowed to take medication on Shabbos, lest you make medication when you need it. Because you're not feeling well, and you say, well, there is no Tylenol around here, but I can grind up acetaminophen and cure myself. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm just going to, you know, just smush it a little bit. And that way it'll be, and that way I'll cure myself. Now,
you can't do that?
Not allowed. Correct. Not allowed. So that's what we're concerned about, that somebody might do. But it's very important to recognize this is specifically when you're talking about the lowest level of illness, what we call miktas choli or mechush, a little bit ill, in some pain. Not somebody who is cholashein bosakana, not somebody who is sakanas, none of those. It's specifically the lowest level of illness that we're talking about. If you take a look at source number 7, the Rambam makes that clear. He writes, crushing peppers in a mortar is liable for grinding. This is not about medicine. This is talking about in general, Shabbos. You want to make something for lunch and you want to crush some peppers. You can't do that on Shabbos. That's grinding. And then he says, therefore, a healthy person may not be treated on Shabbos lest one grind ingredients. So you can't treat somebody with medicine lest you grind. But notice that he said a healthy person. He doesn't mean literally healthy, because if you're healthy, why would you need medication? What he means is somebody who's not in any danger. Their illness is not terrible, but, you know, they have a headache. So, yes, what he's saying is, to go back to Gabriella's question, he's saying you're not allowed to take medication on Shabbos in such a circumstance, lest you grind ingredients. Kyle.
We said that you can't gargle garlic.
No, the vinegar one, right? Vinegar. That was the vinegar?
Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
Is that palm water or oil of roots? Like?
Right, so I didn't want to get into the palm water and oil of roots case because...
So why can't you just gargle vinegar? What's wrong with that?
So the issue is that gargling is something that people do with, like, a medication. I mean, today we take mouthwash, but mouthwash was not a thing for them. So if you saw somebody walking around gargling with vinegar, you know, you saw somebody take vinegar and just, you know, gargle it around, you would understand they're trying to take care of something in their mouth. As opposed to, you just put a salad dressing, and in the course of eating it, you expose your mouth to it. You know, it's like if anybody has a canker sore ever, right? Cold sore, like in the mouth, right? So when I was growing up, what they did for little kids, I don't think you can do this anymore, but no, they would take brandy. Yeah, so they put brandy on it. I mean, it wasn't like a lot. You'd take a Q-tip or something, and you would just touch it to the spot. So I'll tell you, it works. I'm not giving medical advice, I'm not giving legal advice, nothing. But the point that I'm making is, if you saw somebody take, let's say, a syringe and take some brandy with it and then drop it on something in their mouth, you would say, oh, that person is taking medicine. On the other hand, if you saw that person take a shot glass, put some brandy in it and just swish it around in their mouth, you would say they're drinking.
So it's not to give the impression that they're drinking.
So it's more than just the impression. We'll get to it. Not this week, but next week. We'll see why it's okay. We haven't answered the question of why it's okay. Natalie and then Ricky.
What if, like, the Kavanah of them eating the vinegar salad begins to heal their mouth?
Right. So I'm going to come back to this next week. I just like Kyla's question. We'll see. Ricky.
What do we consider, like, other
injuries? So it's the person who's in that lowest category. The person who has the headache, but it's a mild headache and not a migraine, whatever. The person who can walk around fine. They're just irritated because they have a headache or a cough or something like that. Stomach, you know, the stomach's not feeling great. Okay, you know, people survive stomach aches and it's not the end of the world. So what are we worried about here when we talk about, you know, lest you grind ingredients? So if you take a look at source number 8, Rashi frames the issue. Number 8 is the Gemara Rashi is commenting on. In the Gemara number 8, Mar Ukva says, quoting Shmuel, Shmuel, not the Navi, Shmuel, one of the Amoraim from the Gemara, he was actually a doctor as well. So he talks about some kind of an eye treatment called Kilorin, which was prepared by soaking some plant material in a liquid. And he says you're allowed to soak it before Shabbos, and then put it on your eye on Shabbos without concern. You prepared the medicine before Shabbos, you're allowed to use it on Shabbos. Why is that? I thought you just told me don't take medicine on Shabbos. What's the issue? So Rashi explains in source number 9. He explains what Mar Ukva is thinking. Abby, I just want to go through the number 9 first. To him, to Mar Ukva, since they required him to soak it before Shabbos, they said to him, you want to be able to take this Kilorin, you need to prepare it before Shabbos. There is a reminder, and there's no concern. So we're not worried that he's going to forget and grind things up. And one who sees him doing it, and this goes, I guess this does go back to the question of why it's okay to gargle, to use the vinegar as a salad dressing or whatever. He says, one who sees him is going to think he's just washing, thinking that this is wine. Apparently, there was a practice of washing your eyes with wine back in the day. I can't explain that. It just was. You can explain why people would do that? Yeah, what Rashi is trying to do is Rashi's trying to explain why it's okay for me to use this Kilorin that I prepared before Shabbos. Yeah. Without them become us. So let me just explain the logic first, and then we'll see the application. What he's saying is, I have two concerns. Concern number one is you might come to grind something. Concern number two is people who are watching what you do may think that it's okay to grind for medication. So you've solved the problem of lest you grind things by saying, prepare before Shabbos. But you actively prepared it. In other words, you had to sit down and say, before Shabbos, I am doing it, and therefore you will be aware. Don't do it. Hey, we're not there yet. That's issue number one. Because we made you prepare it before Shabbos, you know, don't do it on Shabbos. Number two, all the people who are watching don't know you're taking medicine at all. They think you're just washing your eye out, like from dirt. You know, it's not a... And therefore you're going to be okay. That's what Rashi is saying, meaning the concern that we have is people might think they're allowed to grind in order to get medicine. It's not necessarily even this medicine right now. They might think in the future they're allowed to, and therefore you need to make sure to educate people so that they don't make that mistake. That's the idea. Yes, Ricky?
Why is it your responsibility?
Oh, that's a bomb question for all of Judaism. Why does it matter what other people... Yes. So here's a really funny thing. We have two competing considerations in halacha. One is the one you just mentioned, don lekavzchus. People who see you doing something have to assume the best. Then we have the other one, which is maris ayin. You have to be careful, or ve'yisem nekiyim is the technical term. You have to be innocent in the eyes of others. You can't do anything that's going to cause people to think that you're doing something wrong. Both positions, even though they're competing, are true. Other people have to be concerned about my welfare, and I have to be concerned about other people's welfare.
Yeah, but like, let's say if you just have a headache, you're just like very uncomfortable. Like, why would you want to be thinking about what other people?
And
like you're just like,
this is an overarching value. This is an overarching value in Judaism that I am indeed my brother's keeper, so to speak. I am responsible to worry about other people as well, and potentially misleading them when it comes to the laws of Shabbos. There are two separate concerns when it comes to Maariv Zayin, right? One concern is they might think it's allowed. The other concern is they might think I'm a bad person. You know, they know I'm not allowed to do it, and they think, wow, he's breaking the law, and he doesn't care. Why is that? So you might say, well, I have a stomachache. I don't care what he thinks about me breaking the law. But you haven't solved the problem of, yeah, but I might also mislead other people. And we are really concerned about what other people think overall. We care about community. We care about, you know, the people around us. That's the way it works. But, yeah, Tova.
For the
Yeah.
It's like a thing, like, so
some kind of an ointment that they prepare.
So, even though it's like normal to like wash your eyes with wine, would the washing your eyes with wine allow the shaman?
Yeah, because it's washing. Washing is not considered medicinal. So no, it seems to be some kind of an herb that you soaked in a liquid, and then you use the liquid itself, you know, pouring it in your eye. Sorry?
The soaking
was before Shabbos.
But if you can play wine, you're washing your eyes with that herb.
No, you're using the liquid that you soaked the herb in.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's how it works. I mean, I'm not an expert on Kiloren at all, and I don't know what herb it was. Couldn't tell you. But the issue here is, to be very clear, it's not that you might grind right now. You have the medicine in front of you. It's that you might end up thinking, or others might end up thinking, that it's okay to grind because people are sick. Therefore, you're allowed to grind the medicine. That's the consideration. Now, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, who I mentioned last time, in source number 10, spells this out. And he makes the point that I'm looking at the end. 1 second.
I have a question on what you said before.
Let me just do source number 10 first, because number 10 is going to we'll read all of it. He's going to explain Rashi the way I just did, but in his words, and then add a note at the bottom of the source. He says Rashi was precise, explaining that in this case there is no concern the user might err. The case of this kilorin, since there is a reminder. Right? Because you did it before Shabbos. Well, he's not concerned for others who see. They think it's just washing the eye. And he says, the Ran says the same thing as well. We may deduce from here that wherever there is no reminder for the user, or even if others can see that he's using this as medicine, there is a general concern for grinding ingredients that they might err, the user might err, or others might err, thinking that one may grind ingredients for this. They were concerned that if we would permit using medicine for aches, since people are upset about their pain, if we permit him, then he will come to grind when he doesn't have available anything prepared. Once you tell people that they're allowed to do, you know, this medication, they might make medication because people are upset when they're not feeling well, and they don't necessarily think straight, they don't necessarily investigate, and therefore they're going to do it. Ariana, did that clarify anything?
Yeah, so I'm confused because the issue for not grinding is because other people might see you grinding your medicine and think it's okay, but if you're going to save someone's life with that medicine, when is that?
We're not talking about life-saving.
Oh, fine.
We're just on that lowest level of miktsas choli. That's the only case we're talking about. Correct. Okay. So that leads to the big question, which is nobody, I think... yes? What the Tzitzel Eliezer is doing is he's clarifying what Rashi was trying to say, because you're reading Rashi, you wouldn't necessarily understand it, but he's clarifying what Rashi is trying to say, and adding the note that it's because people are so upset when they're in pain that they do things that perhaps they end up doing things that they shouldn't, and therefore we need to tell them no medication at all, and that way they don't end up falling into this trap. So the big question is, again, has anybody here ever ground up medicine? No one?
Oh.
Yeah?
Like, I cut medicine in half, is that like...
It's good. One situation in which, in theory, it can come up is someone who doesn't like taking pills, or someone who needs a half dose, potentially cutting it up, but that's subject to debate, because grinding may not apply when you're talking about something that was previously ground up into a powder and then just made into a tablet, and now you're going to grind it up again by cutting it. So that may not be relevant. But there are cases in which people do, and that's where we're going in this discussion. For the last 150 years, there have been rabbis who have argued this decree should no longer be relevant. Sorry? So hang in there. But their argument is, we don't grind medicines. We buy them in a store, right? If I wanted to, I wouldn't know how to, right? What would I do in order to make Tylenol? What would I do in order to make Advil? Like, it's silly. What am I going to do to make antibiotics? I mean, antibiotics are a different story. They're not mixed as whole. But like, why are we concerned about this in our day? So I'm going to say this outside of the text, in the interests of time and making sure that we get this, you know, through this before the end of the class. Now, if there's time, I can go back and say it more. But it's in sources 11 and 12 for those who want to read it inside. There are two arguments here. Argument number one is to say that the decree should not be relevant anymore. That a decree which loses its reason disappears. And there's precedent for that argument. The Gemara talks about not clapping to a tune on Shabbos, like rhythmically, on Shabbos, because of concern that if you do, someone is going to start, you know, playing music, and they're, you know, it's not quite in tune, so they'll fix the instrument, and then they'll end up you know, fixing something on Shabbos, which is biblically prohibited. So therefore, don't do it. You know, you say to yourself, well, who would do that? I don't know. If I have a guitar and it's not quite tuned right, and I just turn the thing on the head of the guitar, you know, that could potentially be a problem of fixing my instrument on Shabbos. So therefore, we don't want you clapping. However, already centuries ago, they said, we don't do that. We tend not to tune instruments. And therefore, there are many halachic authorities who say it's no problem for you to clap to a tune at this point on Shabbos, because the reason for it is not really relevant anymore. Another one, there's a rabbinic practice not about Shabbos. There's a rabbinic decree against drinking liquids that have been left overnight without being covered. Because, going back to the Gemara, there was a concern about snakes potentially drinking from the liquid and some of the venom passing into the liquid. Lest you think that's not true, you should be aware, you can look it up online if you don't believe me, because the internet only says true things, that there are different kinds of snake injection methods when it comes to venom, and there are snakes that are spitters that actually do spit venom as opposed to biting into something. It's a longer discussion, look online. But the point is that that was a concern. However, rabbis living in 12th century France and Germany, yeah, that area, said, we don't have that. We don't have snakes among us, and therefore they said, so this won't apply. That's the argument. So the argument here goes, since we don't grind to make medicine, therefore this decree doesn't apply. That's the argument. Gabriella.
Oh, I was just going to ask that.
Okay. So that's the argument. That's one argument. However, one of the problems with that argument is it's not so clear when you're able to do that with a rabbinic decree. We have a general principle, and this is what you were starting to say before, Rina. We have a general principle that says that you're not allowed to simply overturn a rabbinic decree. You need a rabbinic court, the equal of the one that set up the decree, in order to do that. So that argument doesn't necessarily work. The other argument, I'm trying to figure out the best way to do this, and I'm not sure because I'm trying to fit it all in terms of time. I think the best way for me to do it is actually to use source number 11. I'm going to skip number 12, but I'm going to use number 11. Look at Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg and the way he presents it. He says, according to the explanation offered for the view of the Rambam, the Tur, the Shulchan Aruch, which emerges from the words of the Taz, that one may not treat, even with a method that does not involve grinding, there's a possibility of treating via grinding. He says, according to the view, that the reason why we don't take medicine is because of concern for grinding. He says, the rule in our day, when there are cures for particular illnesses which no individual could prepare via any means, then it must be fine to take them on Shabbos in a case of pain, since there's no possibility of healing this illness via grinding ingredients at all. If so, it was not included in the decree. Those were the words that I wanted you to see. The last words in that paragraph, if you're looking at the top of the third side, I think it's top of the third side, it actually depends on which edition of the source sheet you have, but the words, if so, it was not included in the decree, is the key. Racing is never good, but let's see if we can explain this. We're going to get to next time some of the exceptions to the rule about taking medicine on Shabbos. One of the exceptions to the rule is a medical treatment which could not possibly be made by grinding ever. No one would ever do it by grinding. I'm going to give you an example. We'll talk about a case in which someone has a dislocated jaw. So massaging the jaw back into place, if they have a dislocated jaw, you can take all the medicine you want. Your jaw is not coming back, right? You need to push it into place. So therefore, we're going to see there's no problem putting it back in place on Shabbos because there's no concern that you're going to come to grind ingredients. The two things are completely separate. Do you understand what I'm saying? If a medical treatment could not be done via grinding ingredients, it's not subject to this rule. So Rabbi Waldenberg makes the argument that since we couldn't possibly treat fevers by grinding things, therefore, there's no prohibition against taking medicine for a fever on Shabbos. Do you understand? That's his argument. No, because we didn't get to the conclusion yet. That's the potential argument that he's presenting. Again, Ariana?
I don't understand. To cure medicine, doesn't usually take Tylenol to,
To cure?
To cure a headache, I'm saying. A fever. A cure for a fever is usually medicine.
Yes.
So how would taking medicine not lead to grinding?
Because the argument is because we don't grind to make those medications. Someone in a factory somewhere does. But I couldn't make Tylenol if you gave me the actual powders, like the actual, root things. I wouldn't know what to do. Is that clear?
Yeah.
So the first argument is different from the second one. And we're going to have to start with this again next time. The first argument is that this is not subject to the decree. Forget repealing the decree. The decree never applied to medical treatments that don't require grinding. They only apply to treatments that require grinding. Since today no one grinds, Tylenol, I can take Tylenol on Shabbos. That's the argument. Argument number two is to say the whole decree doesn't apply anymore because no one grinds medication. Get rid of the entire decree altogether. That's the second argument. Tova. So good. We have to get to that. We're not at that point, but we do have to get to that question. But I want to make sure that we at least understood that. What we did today was we finished the categories of illness, right? We dealt with the chola she'en bo sakana, we dealt with sakanas eiver, we dealt with mechush, right? We saw the table with those different levels of illness. And we started to see this decree against taking medicine for somebody who is only mildly ill. And we said that it's lest you grind things. And now we saw that there's a competing view that says that shouldn't apply nowadays, either because the original decree didn't apply to treatments that don't need grinding, and this doesn't need grinding, we don't grind for it, or because the whole decree doesn't apply anymore in our day. So what we're going to do next time before we do the quiz is going to be to discuss and explain that a little bit further, and the arguments against it, and then we'll have the quiz. Thank you.
Thank you.